These days, the demand for corn seems insatiable. The ethanol industry, livestock, and export markets can't get enough. When a recent USDA report predicted lower yields than previously expected, prices spiked even higher. And economists say demand will likely continue to exceed supply for some time. As Harvest Public Media's Kathleen Masterson reports, all of this has some investors treating corn like the new gold.
On a recent sun-beaten afternoon, I'm traveling with two corn buyers from Heartland Co-op in Des Moines to Vernon Flynn's farm just outside of town. They're visiting to check the crop's progress. For a more accurate estimate, you need to check the corn away from the edge of the field. So we wrestle our way through the towering 8-foot corn stalks, shielding our faces to keep from being cut by the sharp leaves. Flynn twists off an ear of corn to examine how the heat has damaged it.
That one there is kind of a nose back, probably due to dry weather. This here is probably 16 rows around, and it looks like there's probably 4 or 5 kernel rows right there in that row that's aborted or will not fill.
Still, when they measure the ears and count kernels back at the pickup, Flynn estimates a pretty decent crop, about 170 bushels per acre, compared to 153 projected nationally. Farmers planted far more acres of corn this year, so even though flooding and drought lowered yield per acre estimates, harvest time could still bring a good-sized haul. But demand from the ethanol industry, livestock feed, and export market continues to outstrip yield projections, says Iowa State University economist Chad Hart, and that sent grain prices soaring.
When you looked last summer, we had corn prices in some cases down around $3.50 a bushel. Now we're up in the $6 to $7 range, so we've seen nearly a doubling of prices, if you will, over that past 15 months.
The USDA report suggests that grain prices will stay elevated over the next year or so. Corn stockpiles are nearing a 15-year low, and soybean stockpiles have been tight for at least 4 years. And in the last few months, another player has taken a bite out of the U.S. corn market.
China's been a very early buyer of the corn crop we're growing now. And so they've already, if you will, put in some advanced purchases. And that's been something that has got the market a little worked up right now.
China bought some 21 million bushels from the U.S. in July, its biggest purchase in 15 years. Now, high grain prices are usually good news for farmers. They help Vernon Flynn buy a new tractor. But today's even higher prices mean even higher stakes. And Flynn says selling in this volatile market comes with risks.
I mean, you're kind of scared to sell it for fear you're going to miss the rally. And you're scared if you don't sell it for fear we're going to say, oh, heck, we should have sold it all last time.
Driving his truck over to the next cornfield, Flynn and corn buyers Nick Hyde and Ron Grosskreutz discuss what every farmer struggles with, enormous swings in the market.
It was a lot more fun when corn was $3 and it would move, maybe the limit was 10 cents. And if it moved 10 cents in a day, you know, that was huge.
If it moved a nickel in a day, you were looking for a meteorite.
And now they're saying corn is average this year, is this right, Ron, 22 or 23 cents a day? A day in a move? Well, unheard of.
And more traders are betting not just on gold and precious metals, but on agricultural commodities. They're speculating on corn prices for years to come. Money in corn futures is 5 times what it was in 2004, according to numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. That's nearly a $2 trillion market for corn alone. Farmers and traders alike are getting pretty worked up over the possibility of $8 a bushel corn. But for consumers, this market frenzy translates into higher food prices. Grocery items that rely heavily on grains like meat, butter, and eggs are likely to keep going up. And much of it traces back to corn, which may just be the emerging gold standard of agricultural commodities. For NPR News, I'm Kathleen Masterson.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. When the film Fort Apache, The Bronx came out in 1981, it was a hit. Paul Newman played a conflicted cop in a neighborhood ravaged by poverty and drugs. Fort Apache was also controversial. Local community leaders fought with the producers and threatened to sue because of the way the film depicted blacks and Puerto Ricans. As part of our series On Location, NPR's Joel Rose visits the South Bronx 30 years later.
Fort Apache, The Bronx opens in an empty lot full of rubble. A graffiti-covered subway car rumbles by on an elevated track, and a strung-out prostitute, played by Pam Grier, walks up to a police car where two rookie cops are still sipping their morning coffee.
Y'all want to come party with me?
Not now, baby.
I got some fine for New York's finest.
Well, we're on the job.
I'm on my J-O-B, too, just like you. An important job. Y'all just take a look at this.
After shooting the cops, Greer stumbles off. Local citizens emerge from the shadows, grabbing the badges and wallets out of the cops' pockets. At the time, New York City cops really did talk about the neighborhood as hostile territory. That's how the station house in the 41st Precinct earned the nickname Fort Apache.
You know, our lockers were on the third floor, and somebody from across the street shot arrows through the window.
Former cop Peter Tessitore worked at the 41st Precinct in the 1960s. The way Tessitore tells it, one of his colleagues did not take kindly to those arrows.
And Gil said, you know, with a little profanity, what the is this? You know, Fort Apache meaning John Wayne's movie with Indians, etc.
The movie is loosely based on the experiences of Tessitore and another former officer. They were the inspiration for the main character Murphy, played by Paul Newman. Murphy is a tough but honest cop who cheerfully keeps order on his beat, delivers the occasional baby, and flirts with the nurse at the local hospital.
You need a drink.
I need a nurse.
You supply the booze, I'll supply the nurse.
You asking me out? I get asked out by about 200 nurses every day. Why should I say yes to you?
Because you say yes to all the others.
The 41st Precinct earned another nickname, too, Little House on the Prairie. By 1980, two-thirds of the people who lived in the precinct had fled. Hundreds of landlords resorted to setting buildings on fire to collect the insurance money. And community activists who remained in the South Bronx were not happy to see a high-profile Hollywood production.
They were in our neighborhood. This was our territory. And they were an invading force. They were here to really do us harm, not physical, but rather film something that was not totally true.
This is Herson Barrero. In 1980, he was part of a group of local activists who called themselves the Committee Against Fort Apache. They got a copy of the script before shooting, and they complained that most of the black and Puerto Rican characters portrayed in the film were pimps or drug addicts or worse. The committee demanded changes to the script, they threatened to sue, and they organized public demonstrations against the filmmakers.
Some of the protesters did go a little too far, and yes, there were security concerns on their part.
It got tense.
Christopher Novak was the film's art director.
They started demonstrating and wanting to obstruct shooting. So we had to have security on, and the police presence made it even more difficult. So it was a very tense situation.
Novak says the producers would deliberately try to keep the shooting locations secret in order to avoid clashes with demonstrators and other angry residents.
We had a couple of incidents where people got on the rooftops and threw things down at the crew, like toilets. Shattering porcelain from six or seven stories is a pretty exciting event.
The same thing actually happens in the movie when rioters throw a toilet off the roof at the cops. The film's producer, Gil Champion, remembers things differently. He says reports of the protesters disrupting the shoot were exaggerated.
We did change a couple of locations, which we felt wouldn't be the best place to shoot at. But all in all, despite what might have come out in the press, we shot the movie on schedule, on time, made a lot of friends.
Champion says relations with the local residents were basically good, and he rejects the charge that the filmmakers were there to exploit the neighborhood.
We were exposing something that the world hadn't seen, that there was areas like this within our country, and that hopefully there was a chance for people to earn a better life somehow.
Champion says the production also spent a lot of money in the South Bronx and hired neighborhood residents to work as extras. But art director Christopher Novak says there weren't enough jobs available to satisfy the locals.
A movie crew, even though there's a lot of people on it, everybody has a very skilled position in it. And it's also all unionized, and so that was a difficult situation. So we couldn't really offer them jobs.
In interviews at the time, Paul Newman did seem troubled by the charges of racism leveled at the film, but he insisted the script was just as tough on the cops as it was on the pimps and drug dealers. The filmmakers deny that they changed the script to suit the protesters, though Herson Barrero thinks otherwise.
You still have the blacks and Latinos and Puerto Ricans being prostitutes, dope peddlers. I mean, the bad guys. But we saw in the films there was some conveyance of that there were white officers who were really bad also.
The protesters and other activists tried to organize a boycott of Fort Apache when it opened in 1981, but the movie was a box office success despite, or maybe in part because, of their efforts. The protesters did get one thing they wanted. At the beginning of the film, a written disclaimer flashes on the screen acknowledging that the film doesn't deal with law-abiding members of the community or, quote, the individuals and groups who are struggling to turn the Bronx around.
We're right in front of the infamous 41st Precinct of the New York City Police Department.
Still, I met Harrison Barrero outside Fort Apache. In the 1990s, this stone bunker of a building was converted into office space for police detectives. Even Barrero had trouble recognizing it.
I mean, this is a beautiful building. I mean, it could be any government building. But it used to be an intimidating place with police officers hanging out and looking out like if somehow they were going to be assaulted. It looked like a fortress.
Today, the vacant lots around Fort Apache are filled in with new apartment buildings and single-family homes. It's a diverse, working-class neighborhood. If you're looking for the burned-out shell the South Bronx used to be, you'll have to rent the movie because you won't find it here. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
Our program is directed by Jonathan Baer, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
At the Washington desk, Ron Elving, Beth Donovan, Neil Carruth, Kathy Shaw, and E.B. Stone. Our executive producer is Christopher Turpin. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. A Russian rocket carrying an unmanned cargo ship blasted off this morning, but it suffered a serious failure and pieces came crashing back to Earth. This was the first attempt to launch a spacecraft to the International Space Station since NASA retired its space shuttles last month. The U.S. now depends on Russian rockets like this one to carry up both cargo and astronauts, so today's accident was an unwelcome surprise, NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports.
At first, the launch seemed to be going fine. The rocket blasted off from Kazakhstan into a cloudless sky. But around 5 minutes into the flight, there was a problem. The head of Russia's Mission Control Center later radioed up to the commander of the space station and said that flight controllers had lost contact with the cargo ship.
This is it for the moment. We'll try and figure it out. What has happened, what the cause was.
News reports from Russia described an explosion and pieces falling to the ground in Siberia. NASA quickly held a press conference with Mike Seffredini, the program manager for the space station.
It's a challenging process right after an anomaly because everybody wants answers, and really what you need is time to collect the data and sort it out.
He said the cargo ship had been loaded with nearly 3 tons of food, fuel, and supplies. But NASA's final shuttle mission last month stocked up the outpost, so there's no danger of running out of anything critical.
We can go several months without a resupply vehicle if that becomes necessary.
He said this rocket is very similar to the one Russia uses to carry up people, so the investigation could delay a launch scheduled for next month to take up 2 cosmonauts and an American astronaut. The 3-station crew members they were supposed to replace may stay on orbit longer, or they may come home using a Russian spacecraft already parked at the station, and the outpost would get by with half its normal crew.
Operating at a 3-crew size is something that we're familiar with and able to do, although it would have implications on our ability to perform research.
The incident highlights how, with the shuttles gone, NASA is dependent on Russia for spaceflight. John Logsdon is a space policy expert with George Washington University.
I think critics of the dependence on Russia will seize on this as an example of what might happen. But accidents do happen in the space business. They happen to everybody.
He says for over a decade, Russia has had a long record of successful flights to the station.
But there have been a couple of recent Russian failures that are a little troubling.
He says these raise questions about the state of quality control in the Russian space industry. For example, just last week, a problem with a different rocket put a major communications satellite in the wrong orbit. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. In Europe, banks have slashed tens of thousands of jobs in recent weeks, and in the latest announcement, the Swiss banking giant UBS said yesterday it's cutting 3,500 jobs around the world. Craig LaMalt from member station WSHU has this report from Connecticut, the home of the bank's U.S. headquarters.
Rumors that UBS could move its headquarters out of Connecticut have been traded for months. But in Stamford yesterday, Governor Daniel Malloy said UBS is staying put.
Suffice it to say that this building will be occupied and it will be a major continuation of the total UBS footprint in the Americas. And at a minimum, we protect 2,000 jobs.
But if UBS is committing to keeping 2,000 employees in Connecticut, and the bank currently employs 3,500 people in the state, does that mean...
No, we're not announcing a layoff for 1,500 people here in the state of Connecticut today.
That's Philip Lofts, the CEO of UBS in America. He stresses the 2,000 employees staying in the state is a minimum. The bank won't disclose where any of the global layoffs will be happening. Loft says UBS is looking at ways of saving money.
We need to look at how do we make the firm more efficient, improve our agility. So it's a cost exercise as opposed to purely a headcount exercise.
As an incentive to stay in Connecticut, the governor says UBS is getting a $20 million forgivable loan from the state for infrastructure spending and could get more money if they add more jobs. For NPR News, I'm Craig LaMalt in Stamford, Connecticut.
Just a few weeks ago, the Rixos Hotel in Tripoli seemed like the scene of some absurdist drama. The guests were the foreign press corps. They'd been allowed into the country by the government, but only on the condition that their movements were controlled by government minders. The minders tried to limit the reporters' exposure to only the most glowing view of a crumbling regime. In recent days, it turned into more of a horror show. The reporters effectively became hostages of pro-Gaddafi gunmen until today, when they were finally allowed to leave the hotel, and that included reporter Missy Ryan of Reuters. Welcome to the program once again.
Thank you.
And first, when did life in the Rixos Hotel change from just being editorially constraining to being really frightening?
The conditions really began to deteriorate last Saturday when the rebels entered Tripoli. And at that point, there was fighting raging across the city. And many of the government minders that we've been dealing with the entire time during my stay suddenly disappeared. There was fighting quite close to the hotel, and we were prevented from leaving.
Prevented by whom?
Gunmen associated with the Gaddafi government. They were volunteers, but there were also snipers surrounding the hotel.
And did they understand that you and the others were foreign journalists? Did they regard you as allies of the rebels? How did they treat you?
They certainly did, and they told us that they were preventing us from leaving for our own protection, that fighting would present an imminent danger to ourselves, and they were responsible for our safety. Certainly there may have been other reasons to keep us there. I don't know that I would go as far to say that we are hostages, but we were unable to walk out the door. We were prevented at gunpoint several times from doing so. It was a tense experience. There were ups and downs, but fortunately there was a good group of journalists and we banded together. At least part of the time that we were there, we went without power and water. We raided the food stocks in the basement of the hotel. We filled up water jugs and plastic water bottles from the Turkish bath in the hotel. It's a very luxurious hotel. We spent a lot of time sleeping in the hallways and in a windowless room on the second floor of the hotel when there was fighting and shelling going on nearby.
Could you communicate by phone or text with people outside during all that time?
For part of it, we could, and then the cell service dropped out. Normally, we would use satellite phones, but because of the snipers, we couldn't really go outside. There were a few satellite lines. A few organizations had fed satellite lines into their rooms. We were able to share those lines thanks to their generosity. A few people had put BGANs, the satellite transmission devices, outside of their rooms to connect to the internet. My BGAN was actually hit by a sniper yesterday, so that took that out of commission for a while.
You weren't attending it at the time, I assume.
I was actually.
What was that like?
Oh well, it was a sort of loud bang, and I left the room quite quickly. So
you're laughing about it now, but you're saying your room took a hit in effect.
Well, the beacon was right outside the room. So what we would do is I was sitting on the floor inside my patio with my flak jacket and my helmet on, and you know, you sort of stretch the cord out as far as you can. So it was probably about 3 or 4 feet away.
If you were someday a foreign editor at Reuters or somewhere else and the offer came through, country X is in the midst of a civil war and we can get a reporter in, but they'll be confined to a hotel with government minders, is it an assignment worth taking?
You know, I think it's something I'd have to think carefully about. I think it's important that we were there. Certainly we were able to have a presence and describe the scene in Tripoli, albeit to a very limited extent. But as a manager, you'd run the risk of having one of your reporters end up in a situation like the group of us did over the past few days. But thankfully, it all worked out peacefully. And I have to thank the Red Cross for arranging cars to take us out of the Rixos today.
Well, Missy Ryan of Reuters, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
About your ordeal. Missy Ryan was in the Rixos Hotel in Tripoli. Now she has moved to the Corinthia Hotel in Libya.